Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
If we conclude our investigations and Israel turns out to be responsible, then Israel will receive its response and it will see what idiocy it has committed.
As Israel's shadow war against Iran ramps up, Tehran warns it's a very bad gamble. Israeli reporter and author Ronan Bergman with the inside look at what's actually happening on the ground, and Democratic Senator Chris Coons on the dangerous challenge it poses for the Biden administration. Plus,
people don't know who she was as an individual. They don't know.
As America continues to wrestle with the shooting of innocent black people, a new doc showcases the life, not the violent death, of a black teenager. The director of the Oscar-nominated Love Song for Latasha joins me. And
we should be revitalizing these sort of human skills that can't be replicated by machines, because that's how we're going to add value.
Surviving automation, tech reporter Kevin Roos tells our Hari Srinivasan how to stop AI from taking your job. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. What is going on between Israel and Iran, and what is the endgame? Tehran is blaming Tel Aviv for Sunday's attack on Natanz, one of its main nuclear sites, calling it an act of sabotage. Israel has not confirmed or denied responsibility, but leaks from the Mossad spy agency suggest this was an Israeli operation. The incident marks a worrying escalation of the long shadow war between the two countries, including little-known tit-for-tat attacks on each other's shipping in the region. And today, Iran said it's going to up its uranium enrichment from 20 to 60%. This, as the Biden administration is hoping for more diplomacy and less confrontation, with talks in Vienna aimed at reviving the 2015 nuclear deal that President Trump pulled out of. So what actually is happening, and will, by accident or design, it lead to another war in the Middle East involving the United States? Ronan Bergman has been covering this for the New York Times, and he's joining me now from Tel Aviv. Ronan, welcome back to the program. So, okay, walk us through exactly what happened at Natanz in a précis, if you like. We know there was sabotage. We've heard from the Iranians that it created a hole big enough for an official to fall into and to injure himself. What happened? How did it happen?
So, Christian, the Iranians, since Trump woke from the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal, started to reignite their enrichment program and did their violation of the JCPOA, started to enrich more and more to a low level, and position many, most of the centrifuges for the enrichment of uranium underground in the bunkers that they have built in the previous decade in Natanz. That's their main enrichment facility. They built it over there under an enforced concrete roof that is thick enough to sustain what they feared, an aerial bomb from Israel. After, in July, an attack that was another attack, another secret attack that was attributed to Israel by the Iranians in the one of the above-the-ground facilities in Natanz, the Iranians relocated almost all of their enrichment effort to underground, believing that it's safe over there. They have sustained, Natanz have sustained numerous cyber attacks. They were able to build walls and air-gapped computers and air-gapped power grid. And all that didn't help, because Sunday morning, early morning, someone bombed the internal power grid that the Iranians believe is to be completely safe, and completely shut down the whole of the enrichment process inside Natanz, which is inside the bunker, which is most of what Iran can do in the terms of enrichment of uranium.
All right, so the question is, who did it? Because obviously the finger is being pointed, obviously, by Iran, but in many news reports also at Israel. You know that journalists in Israel have quoted intelligence sources saying that this was a Mossad operation. Mm-hmm. Even your army chief has suggested, and let me just get this right, has hinted at the role of Israel in remarks that he made on Sunday. And you know that that's unusual. So first and foremost, what do you know? Who did it?
So two intelligence officials have spoken with the New York Times and confirmed that this was Israel that was behind the attack, that the attack was aimed at this subterranean power grid supplying the electricity for the centrifuges, that it was totally destroyed, that it was not a cyber attack. It was explosives, few detonation, remote detonation of explosives that were smuggled into the facility, possibly long ago, not recently. And they were able to completely destroy the power grid, and that evolved into the collapse of some of those and the destruction of many of those centrifuges. If you put the damage done to the assembly centrifuges facility in July, on top of what happened on Sunday, you come up with a significant damage that Israeli intelligence was able to inflict the Iranians in the place where they thought that they are totally guarded.
Right, but the question again is, it's obviously human. It's obviously a human being who is an agent who went in and did that. And I wonder whether you know who that might be. And secondly, I really want to ask you, because Israel never responds to these. It neither confirms nor denies. But the amount of hinting that it did is strange. And analysts have suggested that that public claiming and boasting of it by Israel requires a response and a retaliation from Iran. So do you, and does Israel expect a retaliation? And if so, how and where?
Well, I'm not so sure about the retaliation. Iran has been very careful in retaliation to all the different sabotages and assassinations. Just to remind us, on the 27th of November last year, Israel assassinated the chief Iranian nuclear scientist who was leading what Israel believed to be the nuclear military path of its project, Professor Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. And there were many others, other operations to which Iran did not react. The only operation to which it did react were the naval attacks, the commando naval attacks on Iranian ships carrying oil and carrying arms to Syria. This is something that Iranians are very careful in creating tete-a-tete. You quoted sources identifying another attack on Israeli ship. And one of the officials, an Israeli official, has told us that Israel is now trying to keep low level, to quiet down the tension, the maritime secret war. But I'm not sure that Israel will allow Iran to continue with its nuclear project, even if Iran signs a new nuclear deal with the United States. And the timing, Christian, the timing is very important. Israel decided to do those things during the negotiation, and the Iranians probably speculate whether this was American blind eye, whether America, the U.S., ordered Israel to do that, not to do that. I think the Iranians now are very much confused. First, how Israel is able to infiltrate their ranks again and again and again and again to the most guarded places. And second, what exactly the U.S. point of view is about all that?
Well, you know, that obviously begs the question. Israel has long wanted the U.S. to back a war in Iran against its nuclear facilities. And, you know, going back to, I guess, George W. Bush, they've always denied Netanyahu that, you know, that military support in that regard. But I'm really interested in what you say about how you don't think Israel will ever allow Iran to have a nuclear program. Let me just read you what the Iranians are saying. The foreign minister, Javad Zarif, has tweeted, deliberately targeting a safeguarded nuclear facility with high risk of indiscriminate release of radioactive material is nuclear terrorism and a war crime. He says the attacks will strengthen Iran's hands at the negotiations. And I want to play this soundbite, what he said today about all of this.
I assure you that Natanz will definitely, in the near future, progress with more advanced centrifuges. And if Israel thought they can prevent Iran and the Iranian people from pursuing the lifting of the sanctions, they've played a very bad gamble.
So how do you think Israel will pursue this? And I also want to ask you about timing, because you talked about timing regarding the nuclear negotiations, but there's also timing regarding Prime Minister Netanyahu himself, who is under, you know, investigation. He started the court case. He's trying to get a coalition together. He's also got a lot of domestic pressure that maybe he'd like to avoid for a while with this kind of situation.
Yeah. Well, let me start with the latter, with your permission. A confrontation with Iran might be very useful for Benjamin Netanyahu, or the other way around. If something is developing to an all-out war, something that will have Israeli casualties, maybe soldiers, maybe commando troops, this will have a very negative effect on the popularity of Mr. Netanyahu. The other thing is those operations takes sometimes not just months, but years to prepare. The Mossad has been known for many, many years in the ability to recruit workers in factories or companies supplying equipment to those places and planting the bombs and the other espionage activity inside those equipment and planting them inside the facilities, sometimes when they are just being erected. And so the capability, even if Benjamin Netanyahu, of course, he needs to approve all operations. But even if he approves something now, the ability to conduct something from a week term or even a month term, I think the chances are okay. Quite slim. On what is happening, what Israel will accept or not, let me just quote the current chief of the Mossad, Yossi Joseph Cohen, who said in some of the meetings that he had with some of colleagues and some foreign colleagues, some directors of intelligence services, said, I did not sign the JCPOA. The only contract, the only obligation I have is for the state of Israel, the people of Israel, and the Jewish people. And my contract with them is to make sure that Iran, that according to Cohen, has an ongoing military nuclear project to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear bomb. And I think this is a very strong statement. And as far as I know, this is the Israeli policy. True or not, justified or not, this is the Israeli policy. And I think Israel, even if a new JCPOA is signed, Israel will continue its secret war that is not going to happen. It's happening now, its secret war against Iran to make sure Iran nuclear project will end up going nowhere.
And you've broken so many of those stories. Ronan Bergman, we're very happy to have you back. And we will continue to tap your insights and your resources and your knowledge. Now, despite what the Israeli government might think, a new report the U.S. intelligence community has put out says that it does not believe Iran is taking any steps to build a nuclear weapon, but that it has breached some commitments in response to Donald Trump pulling out of the nuclear deal back in 2018. So how will President Biden deal with this challenge and head off another U.S. war in the Middle East? Joining us is the Democratic Senator Chris Coons. He's a close confidant of the president, and he is the president's unofficial envoy to the Senate on foreign affairs. So welcome to the program. Welcome back again. Boy, you have your work cut out for you if you believe the very, very well plugged in and highly informed Ronan Bergman and what the Israelis are saying. I mean, they don't want to see your president take the route that he wants to take, diplomacy in order to reduce tensions with Iran around a nuclear program. What are you going to do about it? What is he going to do about it?
Well, Christiane, I expect the Biden administration, President Biden and his senior diplomats, to continue working at the table in Vienna and with our allies and partners around the world and in the region to keep trying to achieve a diplomatic breakthrough with Iran. I am clear-eyed about how difficult that will be. I am asking for and am expecting that we will get a classified briefing on recent developments in Iran, what happened at Natanz, what's happening at the negotiating table in Vienna. But I think it is gravely concerning that Iran's announced they intend to now increase their enrichment rate to 60%, taking them much closer to weapons grade. This is a standoff that has to be resolved. I hope and pray that it will be resolved peaceably. that we will find a path towards a longer and stronger deal that addresses the ballistic missile program, the support for regional proxies and for terrorism that has long marked Iran's regional actions. But frankly, we're in a very tough situation, as the interview you just concluded suggests.
So you're worried clearly about those issues you raised about Iran. Are you worried about your main ally in the region, Israel, using military force, whether it's in the Gulf with that tit-for-tat attacks on each other's shipping, or whether it's using an operative to go in and blow a hole in a nuclear plant? Are you worried about that? And did you have any advance knowledge about it? Did the United States know what Israel was going to do before it did it?
Christian, I had absolutely no sense or information that there was an upcoming incident at Natanz. But I think the Israeli government has been very clear for a long time that they will oppose and take action to prevent Iran developing a nuclear weapon. The United States has also held that policy for some time. It has broad bipartisan support here in Congress that we will take the actions we need to take, but we hope those will be diplomatic actions to prevent Iran from achieving a deliverable nuclear weapon. These recent developments make that more difficult, less certain, and I think it'll call for some closer conversations and cooperation with our vital ally, Israel.
Israel has long tried, particularly Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who's been in office for, you know, more than a decade now, has long tried to suck the United States into some kind of military offensive against Iran. And it's been denied by U.S. presidents from George W. Bush on to now. Are you concerned, as I posed, by accident or by design, the United States could be pulled into another war in the Middle East between Israel and Iran?
Christian, I am concerned that we might be drawn into any regional conflict just because I have heard from so many Delawareans so many times that they are tired of the decades-long wars that we've been engaged in Afghanistan, in Iraq, more recently in Syria. And I think we have to look very carefully at how we balance our national security interests, our values and priorities, and the path forward in the region. I've recently had conversations with senior leaders in some of the Gulf states, and I think the Abraham Accords were a significant and positive step forward, as there are now a number of Arab states that are recognizing Israel and normalizing relations with Israel. That hadn't been even a prospect a few years ago. So I do think there is an opportunity here that the Biden administration can and will seize, that folks here in the Senate can and will take advantage of, for us to make some positive progress in trying to resolve some of these long-standing and difficult conflicts. I think the appetite of the average Delawarean, the average American, for new troop deployments, for a new conflict in the region, are very low, and a conflict against Iran would be even more challenging and even more costly than the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Well, you bring me, of course, to Afghanistan. The news is that the president plans to remove U.S. troops by the 20th anniversary of 9/11. That would be this year, September 11th. He's going to lay it out, apparently, tomorrow. Do you believe that that's in the United States' best interest to remove U.S. troops? And most importantly, do you believe the conditions have been met in Afghanistan to take this step?
Well, Christian, let's be clear about what President Biden inherited. His predecessor had very abruptly decided to withdraw all of our forces from Syria, even though we were in the middle of combat operations with close and trusted NATO allies. They only found out about it on Twitter, and this was the result of a call with the President Erdogan of Turkey. President Trump also made, I think, a relatively abrupt decision to commit to a full withdrawal of American troops by May 1 from Afghanistan. That's a decision that President Biden has very carefully weighed. He's consulted closely with allies. He has had meeting after meeting with senior military and intelligence advisors and has only come to this decision after really weighing all the factors. My first trip overseas as a senator, Christian, 10 years ago, was to Pakistan and Afghanistan. And even then, when we'd been at war in Afghanistan 10 years, it did not seem clear to me that we had a path towards a successful resolution on our terms of all the conditions and actions we were engaged in. We had succeeded in knocking down al-Qaeda and in helping establish a democratic and elected government in Afghanistan. And 10 years later, the costs that we've invested in Afghanistan lead me to believe that President Biden has made the most responsible decision given the situation that he had inherited. The withdrawal by September 1 will happen in close coordination with our allies, with good planning, and in a safe and responsible manner.
You said September 1. Do you mean September 11th? Are you telling me something new?
I meant by early September.
Okay, all right. I guess my question to you, though, is, you know, are you prepared, because U.S. intelligence, again, and also other government officials who deal with Afghanistan and have done over the years, do not believe that the U.S.-backed government there can sustain itself in the absence of troops, and that the advances that the Taliban are making and the complete disregard of the American demands for a peace accord could put the Taliban back in charge? In other words, the very thing you went into Afghanistan 20 years ago to eliminate may happen right now again, right after the 20th anniversary of 9/11.
Christian, to be clear, I was not here in the Senate at the time, but my strong impression was the very thing we went into Afghanistan to prevent was Al-Qaeda having a base of operations. A decades-long war to build a successful, independent, democratic republic and to help ensure their security is an effort that I have concluded would have no reasonable end in the next 5 to 10 years. So for those who say we should stay for another year or another two, they have to look clearly at just how much we have invested over the last 20 years and just how much the world has changed in those 20 years. The several trillion dollars that we poured into the conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq, our now competitor China has instead poured into rebuilding and modernizing their armed forces, into being our peer competitor in manufacturing and innovation. We face an aggressive Russia and an aggressive Iran and an ascendant China. We're in a different place in the world than we were 20 years ago. And I respect President Biden and trust that he weighed all of these things carefully in making what I'm sure was a very hard decision about this timing, to make a decision to responsibly withdraw in consultation with our allies.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure it's a hard decision. I know it's America's longest war, but the Taliban are the ones who hosted Al-Qaeda, and there's no guarantee that they won't allow those anti-American terrorists to regroup. But let me just move on, because the president has sent you to another part of the world, to Ethiopia in Africa, where you have just returned from, to try to rein in and get a stop to the atrocities that are being committed in the war there. Can you tell us about it? And I believe you've had exchanges of letters from one president to the next and from the prime minister back to President Biden.
That's right, Christian. I was asked by President Biden to serve as a special emissary to Prime Minister Abiy of Ethiopia, who, I'll remind you, just a few years ago won the Nobel Peace Prize for bringing to a conclusion the longstanding war between Ethiopia and Eritrea. In a conflict that began in November in Tigray, his federal forces, the Ethiopian National Defense Forces, have been fighting the TPLF, a regional army or militia that really was dominant in Ethiopia for decades. There were a few pressing issues that I raised with the prime minister. He met with me for 5 hours over 2 days. He was very generous with his time. I delivered a letter directly to him from President Biden, and I brought a letter back to President Biden from Prime Minister Abiy. A couple of key developments. He made commitments about humanitarian access throughout Tigray. He made commitments and then publicly stated he recognized there have been human rights violations committed by his own troops, by Eritrean troops, by the Amhara militia, by the TPLF, and committed to an international investigation in partnership with the Ethiopian Human Rights Commission. Most importantly, he recognized publicly for the first time the presence of Eritrean troops in his country, and then made a trip to Asmara to meet with President Isaias of Eritrea to demand that he withdraw his troops. That was a significant step forward. We are looking for action across these three key commitments, and there are also other regional concerns about the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam and a border dispute with Sudan. There was progress made on all of these fronts, but there is still more that has to be done. The Prime Minister made some important commitments. I'm going to be working closely with the Biden administration to make sure that those commitments are followed up on.
That would be really important because, as you say, there's some terrible atrocities that are being committed, and we've been following them with our correspondents and will continue to do so. So thanks for that, Senator. I just want one last question. The Russian foreign minister is in Iran. He is hoping to tamp down tensions. He says that it is in their interest and all of your interest to see the nuclear deal revived. I want to ask you, as a U.S. senator, is the nuclear deal, and for the U.S. to get back into it, of national security interest to the United States? And if so, would you tolerate an ally, Israel, trying to disrupt it by any means necessary, as we heard from our previous interview?
I do think it's in America's vital national security interest to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. And I think if we can accomplish that by diplomatic means, that is far preferable. And if we can accomplish a broader and bolder deal that puts to rest the legitimate concerns of our partners and allies in the region, that is the best possible outcome. And I think it's important that we continue to have respectful public and private conversations with our close partners and allies in the region, and in particular that we understand the legitimate and unique concerns of Israel, given how many times Iran has threatened Israel's security. This is a tough road for us going forward, Christian, but I look forward to working with my partners here in the Senate and with the Biden administration to make sure that there's full consultation and that the path forward ultimately is one that prevents Iran from getting a nuclear weapon.
Lots and lots of challenges on your plate. Senator Coons, thank you so much indeed for joining us. Protests took hold of Minneapolis for a second night after a police officer shot and killed a young black man, Dante Wright, during a traffic stop. This as the city is already consumed by the trial of Derek Chauvin for the murder of George Floyd. But before Dante Wright and before George Floyd, there was LaTosha Harlins. In 1991, the 15-year-old was killed by a Los Angeles convenience store owner who falsely accused her of stealing. Her death and the beating of Rodney King by LAPD that year prompted the devastating LA riots a whole year later. In January this year, a mural celebrated what would have been LaTosha's 45th birthday. And the new documentary, A Love Song for LaTosha, is shining a light on the girl who had so much promise.
People don't know who she was as an individual. They don't know. They just know that she was just a young black girl who was worth $1.79. They don't know.
Now, the short documentary film is attracting major awards buzz. It's nominated for an Oscar, and I'm joined now by its director, Sophia Nali Allison. Welcome to the program. It is an amazing film, and I was so glad that I was directed to watch it by colleagues who are also involved in the production of it. And I just wanted to ask you to explain to us first, who was LaTosha Harlins, and why don't we know about her?
Hi, how are you? Thank you so much for having me. LaTosha Harlins was a young black girl who had dreams of a future, who was really focused on community care, on collective care, who was focused on wanting to see her friends excel, wanting to encourage her friends' dreams, her cousins' dreams. When LaTosha was 9 years old, actually, her mother was killed by a gunshot wound, and LaTosha really wanted to be a lawyer because she wanted to fight for justice regarding cases just like her mom. And she is someone that never wanted to become a statistic. After her mom died, she really understood that she needed to protect her siblings, protect her family. Her wonderful grandmother took her and her siblings in. And LaTosha just became someone that young people in the neighborhood looked up to, that were inspired by. LaTosha really was focused on creating something better for herself, for her friends, and really wanted to dream outside of what she saw as her everyday. What she saw was her surrounding in South Central Los Angeles. And she was such an inspiration for her cousin Shanice and her best friend Ty, who are the voices that we hear throughout the film.
And they're really moving voices, you know, very profound, very moving. And she was known, you know, according to what you've all said, as the neighborhood big sister. And you talk about how she wanted to make her community better and wanted to be a lawyer and had, you know, so many dreams and aspirations. And she was also really clever, really smart in school. But the film opens with her doing a big sister kind of thing, right? She comes to the rescue of one of these friends.
Yes. So in the very beginning, we have a story from Ty, her best friend, and Ty is at the community pool and she's trying to swim. She doesn't really know how to, but these boys in the pool start messing with her. They start holding her head under the water. And this is, you know, very scary for a child that doesn't know how to swim. And Latasha's walking by the pool, which is actually in their neighborhood, just a couple of blocks away from where they live. And Latasha hops the fence, jumps in the pool, fights off these boys, and that's the beginning of a beautiful friendship for Ty and Latasha. And it's such a heroic act, you know, of this young girl in middle school to see someone that she's just seen throughout the neighborhood. You know, they weren't really connected yet, but for that to be the moment of understanding, there's going to be this beautiful friendship that comes from this moment. And I think that speaks volumes to who Latasha was. She didn't want to see anyone get messed with. She was a protector. She cared deeply about her friends and her family and would do anything she needed to protect them.
And remind us again, because of course we're in the middle of the trial for the killing of George Floyd.
Yes.
We've had another young black man shot not so far from where that trial is taking place. The officer who shot him has resigned. The police chief of that particular HQ has resigned. But what were the circumstances? I mean, for George Floyd, it was over, you know, a potentially fake $20 bill. For her, she was going into a convenience store to buy orange juice.
Yes, yes. So Latasha was going to buy a $1.79 bottle of orange juice, and the store worker, Soonja Du, accused her of stealing. And she, you know, she and Latasha have a small altercation because Soonja Du provokes the situation, you know, grabs at Latasha, and anyone would react if someone is grabbing at you. You know, Latasha's a 15-year-old child, and that's what I want people to remember the entire time they're watching the film. Latasha was a kid. She was a baby, and she died while holding $2 in her hand intended for the orange juice. And for me, I really want this film to disrupt and to challenge the idea of adultification. So often we see black girls are seen as threats to people because within society, black girls are seen as older than their counterparts. They're seen as older than all the other young children, you know, young white girls, young Asian girls. There is a threat that people are intimidated by black girls, and they associate them with womanhood. They associate them with being adults. And I want people to be reminded that this young girl was not a threat. Even when we read the court documents, the judge at the time, Joyce Carlin, says if Latasha were still alive, she would be here standing before us, which I see as an insult to assume that a young girl would be on trial, that a young girl that we could ever associate what Soonja Du did as justifiable. And that's what the judge stated. You know, she understands why Soonja Du reacted in this manner. She understands why Latasha was seen as a threat. And this is something we've seen happen year after year after year, where black folks who are innocent, the anti-blackness perpetuates this violence. It perpetuates people seeing us as threats. And we've seen historically how young black girls are met with such violent altercations, where we have police officers tackling young black girls, where we've seen guards in school, you know, slam black girls on the ground because people in society have been programmed to see black girls as threatening. And so when the police arrived at the scene where Latasha was killed, they realized from the footage, they realized from the evidence with Latasha holding $2 from this orange juice that she was never intending to steal this. And even a $1.79 bottle of orange juice is never cause for death. And so Latasha, at the end of this moment, Latasha places the orange juice on the counter, turns around to leave, and that's when Soonja Du shoots her. And it's so devastating. And we were very intentional of not placing this footage within the film because we understand how harmful, how traumatizing it is for black folks to see this trauma, for black folks to see violence against ourselves, for black folks to see black death. It's very triggering. It's very traumatic. And that's something that we did not want to harm the community. We did not want to harm Ty, Shanice, or the Harlins family, or anyone that knew her. And so within that moment, rather than showing that footage, we used animation and Ty's riveting memory of how she learned about Latasha's death to tell us this story.
You know, Sophia, it's so interesting to hear you put it this way. And I thought it was an immense act of artistic discipline for you to resist that urge, because you turned it into a love story, into the story of her life rather than her death. Was that what you were also going for? And they've called you and praised you and, you know, your Oscar nomination as being such an experimental director.
Yes, absolutely. That was always the intention of how can we disrupt this idea of what does it mean to interrogate a moment of Black death, a moment of trauma, and not allow for that to be the story. The story is about Latasha's life, and I always wanted this to be a rebirth of her memory, a rebirth of Latasha. I look at A Love Song for Latasha as allowing a spiritual archive to exist. When we don't have archival footage to pull from, how do we rebuild these memories? How do we work with Ty and Shanice to rebuild something that's healing, to reimagine visuals that are healing not only for them, but that really bring to life the story of Latasha Harlins, that allow for other young Black girls to watch this and remember their own brilliance in their Black girlhood, that sacredness of Black girlhood, wanting those who are adults now who remember this story, who remembered seeing that footage, to watch this and be met with life rather than having to experience this trauma over. So we always wanted this film to be something that was healing for the community and healing for Ty and Shanice.
So then I would like to end our interview by asking you to read the poem that she had written.
Yes.
And it's on that huge, well, it's associated with that huge mural that was put up to celebrate or mark her 45th birthday,
yes,
which would have been January 1st. If you wouldn't mind reading the poem, which I know you have there.
Absolutely. And I want to thank our muralist, Victoria Casanova, who was intentional about incorporating this section of the poem.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to read part of it, the part of the poem that's on the mural, but the entire poem could be heard in the film. And so Victoria Casanova included the phrase, "We Queens," which Ty mentions within the film. And then the poem reads, "I am very reliable and trustworthy, honest. I have a lot of talent, and I know whatever I set my mind on something, I can accomplish. I show people I care by giving what I have to people who actually need it." So that's just the section of the poem that's on the mural. But within this poem, she also talks about, if I could have one wish, it would be to have my mother back with me. And that's the part that always really haunts me and stays with me.
Well, it's an amazing film visually and, as you say, spiritually and as storytelling. Oscar nominated. We wish you good luck.
Thank you so much.
And Sophia Nali Allison, thank you so much for joining us.
And
A Love Song for Latasha is streaming now on Netflix. Next up, the increasing automation of so much of our lives. Navigating a future dominated by algorithms and AI is the topic of the new book, Future Proof. In it, the New York Times technology columnist and best-selling author Kevin Roos advises readers on how not to be replaced by a machine at work. And here he is talking to Hari Srinivasan about ways that we can all peacefully coexist with algorithms.
Christiane, thanks. Kevin, thanks for joining us. I mean, we have worried about robots taking over our jobs and making us inconsequential for decades or centuries, right? And it's not a new fear, but how have these big transitions, when we think of, say, the Industrial Revolution, how have these things worked out for the people that are most impacted by it? Because usually the technocratic answer is, hey, you know, this one technology might replace a few jobs, but there's going to be other ones, that there's going to be better ones, that we're going to have all this extra time. So here we are, 2021, where's all my extra time?
Exactly. And this is the paradox, is that automation technology in general is supposed to free us from work. It's supposed to do our dirty work for us and give us more time to spend doing the things that we value. But instead, as our economy has become much more technological and much more automated, we're working more than ever. And many of us are working in jobs that aren't actually all about creativity and intellectual output. AI and automation, in many cases, have made some jobs more monotonous and more boring and more repetitive. So I wanted to sort of dig in and say, like, what is the big picture here? And when you look back at previous waves of technological change, I think the story that's told about them is often the very optimistic one. You know, people say, well, you know, sure, the industrial revolution forced some people to learn new jobs, but all of our lives become better as a result. And I don't think a lot of us would go back and switch existences with our great grandparents. But what you notice, and what I noticed researching this book, was that if you go back and look at the accounts of the people who lived through things like the Industrial Revolution, it was a really hard time for people. There was a lot of poverty. There was a lot of brutal labor conditions. Child labor became very popular. Things that took many decades to resolve. And workers didn't see the benefits of the new technology right away. And in some cases, it took decades for wages to rise, even as companies were making much more money using these new machines.
When we think of robots and automation, we have a tendency to think about the factory floor. But as you point out, like, that horse has left the barn 2 decades ago. Give me an example of some higher order white collar jobs that are actually at threat of being slowly replaced by little pieces of automation.
Yeah, there's been some interesting research done by, among other people, the Brookings Institution and Stanford did a study that found that actually the jobs that are most in danger of being displaced by AI are white collar managerial jobs in analytical or technical fields. So things like sales forecasting is a job that for a long time has been done by college educated humans with specialized training who were paid pretty well. But that is now a job that in many cases can be done by AI. Also jobs like radiology, doctors who specialize in, you know, reading scans and diagnosing tumors and things like that, that can now be done by AI with a much greater accuracy rate than even the best human radiologists. And so these are the kinds of jobs that are increasingly being threatened by AI and automation. It's not just factory workers. It's not just truck drivers. It's not just fast food workers. It's really people in all kinds of jobs who are doing the kind of repetitive, analytical, technical work that can be automated.
Do you think that this will have a greater political impact because, say, for example, white collar people might have more political agency, they might be more connected, more lawyers and doctors might push back at certain things and call their members of Congress in a way that maybe somebody who's being replaced on a factory floor might not have over the last 20 years?
Well, I think what makes that challenging, it's certainly possible, but it's a lot less obvious when a job is being automated now. I mean, in the old days, you would know that your job was in danger because a machine would show up on the factory floor, a physical machine that would be doing the same kind of welding that you used to do. And maybe you would have a union. And so your union would start to worry about this and would bring this up with management and figure out what was going on. Now, most of the white-collar automation is happening in non-unionized workplaces, often with people who don't really realize that their jobs are being automated because it's all happening through software. It's not like you show up one day and a robot is sitting in your seat. It's more like your IT department uses an off-the-rack piece of software that can replace the job that you used to do, and one day it just starts doing that job.
How much of this do you think comes down to just bottom-line margins? I mean, coming out of the pandemic, we've seen, for example, you know, even before the pandemic, we had kiosks at rental car counters that I thought were really strange. I would just much prefer to just deal with a human and get the transaction done faster. And now we have hotel chains that are saying, we're thinking about this too. But under the guise of, we don't want you to get sick from, or our employees to get sick, we're just going to replace this human with this kiosk. I don't know whether this is like the cover that these companies needed to try to roll out these schemes that would just decrease their labor force or what.
Yeah, I talked to a number of AI and automation experts who said that part of the reason that that this technology has exploded during the pandemic is because executives finally had cover. If you know, automate jobs and lay off workers as a result of new technology, People are going to get mad at you, but it's much easier to do that during a pandemic when a lot of layoffs are happening anyway. Businesses are under a lot of financial pressure to cut costs. And so the pandemic kind of gave them an excuse to do the kinds of automation that they wanted to do all along. And I also think there is something happening to the technology itself, which is getting much, much better. Just in the last year or two, we've seen things like GPT-3, which is, you know, this kind of large language model AI that can write, you know, finish people's sentences. So you can write one sentence and it will complete the rest of the paragraph. And people are starting to use this in all kinds of ways. And this is really a breakthrough that I think will ultimately challenge a lot of people's jobs.
So I want to transition to the sort of second half of your book, which might as well have been called Take the Power Back. I mean, it's a quote, Rage Against the Machine. I mean, you know, in a lot of ways, what you're showing in the book is that we have quietly relinquished a lot of what it is that makes us human to some of these suggestion recommendation engines.
Yeah, I think that's really an insightful and important point. I mean, what we thought computers were doing for many years was helping us. I mean, Steve Jobs famously said that computers were bicycles for the mind because they enabled us to do more, to give us new powers. But what's been happening in recent years with AI and other new technologies is that they are driving us, right? We are the bicycles and they are taking us where they want us to go. So Netflix may be recommending a show that it thinks you'll like because it actually thinks you'll like that show, or it might just want to steer viewers to a show that it produced because, you know, it wants you to watch that show. And that's happening more and more, where we're being driven into decisions that we might not actually make for ourselves. And I think that's really dangerous, because part of being a human is being able to make your own choices and exercise your own free will.
So if we're in this place and you have a list of prescriptions on how to future-proof ourselves, I mean, my question shouldn't be necessarily what sort of job is safe, but how do I do whatever job it is that I have that makes it safer from being automated away?
Well, you're exactly right. There's no such thing as a totally robot-proof job. Any job can be automated with enough time and technology. But there are skills and traits that we can have that make us harder to replace. And it all boils down to how human we are, how differentiated we are from a machine. And so every job contains multitudes. You could be a radiologist who just spends all day reading scans in a lab somewhere, and that job is fairly automatable. Or you could be a pediatrician who builds genuine human connections with people, who, you know, coaxes scared children into getting their shots, who is sort of really interesting and humane person to be around. And that will make you actually much harder to automate. In the book, I talk about three categories of work that I think will be very resistant to automation. And I call them surprising, social, and scarce. And surprising work is sort of work that involves lots of chaos and new situations, like being a kindergarten teacher, for example. Social jobs are jobs that involve making people feel a certain way and producing emotional experiences for them, whether it's, you know, a barista serving someone a drink with a smile, or a nurse who's taking care of someone in palliative care. Those jobs are really hard to replace. Scarce jobs are jobs that involve rare skills or combinations of skills or extraordinary ability or high-stakes situations, things like being a 911 operator. We have the technology to automate that job, but we've chosen not to, because when we're in trouble, we want to call 911 and immediately be connected with a human.
So if we're in that world where a computer could write a better paragraph than me, I mean, where should we be thinking about sending our kids to school, so to speak? Because in the 90s, what we were hearing about was this intense push for STEM, STEM, STEM. Ironically, all of these kind of computer programming, software-related jobs, those now can be done almost as well by computer. So should we be teaching kids how to finger paint and play instruments?
Yeah. I mean, in short, we should be revitalizing these sort of human skills that can't be replicated by machines, because that's how we're going to add value. There's no use competing with AI on things like efficiency or accuracy or hustle. You know, it's not impressive that you can work really hard if a machine can work 24/7 and do millions of computations per second. Where we can actually add value and where we can stand out are in these kind of softer human skills like creativity and compassion and collaboration, these things that we generally don't teach once people get to a certain age. There's a venture capitalist who named Frank Chen who recommends to all his founders that they read a book called All I Need to Know I Learned in Kindergarten, which is sort of one of these classic books that's about sort of relearning the skills that we learn as small children, sharing, playing well with others. These are the kinds of skills that have a lot of value in a highly automated world.
So you have a phrase in the book called machine age humanities. What are those? How do we access them? How do we learn them?
Well, strangely enough, I think this is an area where we could look to early childhood educators for guidance, because social emotional learning, these sort of basic human skills, we do teach them to small children and then we stop. And I think we could reintroduce some more of that into higher grade levels. I know there are some courses now that are designed sort of like, they call them things like empathy for engineers, that are basically trying to teach these basic human skills to people who are older and who have more specialized skills. But at medical schools now, for example, there are courses that teach people just how to communicate better with patients, how to deliver hard news, how to comfort people who are grieving or scared. That's something we didn't used to teach medical students, but now as medicine becomes more highly automated, it's not enough to just be a really smart technical doctor. You also have to be good at relating to people.
So what are some examples of businesses maybe that have made conscious choices to avoid the easy button to putting in artificial intelligence, and how that might actually have worked for them because of what it is that they bring to the table now, where maybe it's more human?
Well, there have been some interesting sort of experiments with sort of de-automation. So one example that I talk about in the book is Tesla. They had this period where they were really struggling to meet their production targets. You'll remember this a couple of years ago, but there was a lot of sort of nervousness and anxiety about whether Tesla was making enough cars and whether they were good enough quality. And that turned out to be in large part because they had over-automated their factories. They had basically brought in robots to do all of the work. And they realized that humans were actually better at some of those subtle tasks, better at spotting problems before they cascaded into expensive failures, better at sort of doing the intricate detail work on cars. And so they kicked out some of the robots and brought back in humans and met their production targets. So I think we're starting to see some companies sort of correct for over-automation. There are also companies that are valuable because the thing that they're selling is not automated. I mean, there is a kind of effect I think we're going to see where there's sort of more artisanal goods and services, things that are valuable because they're not automated. It's very cheap to get a mechanically reproduced, you know, print of an expensive painting. It's very expensive to get the handmade original. And I think we're going to start seeing that apply in more sectors of the economy.
You know, one of your prescriptions is to decrease our dependence on our smartphones and devices. And as you described it, and going through your own struggles for decreasing your screen time, I noticed that it seems like we have somehow internalized that efficiency is so important, because even those 2 seconds or 3 seconds that you're standing in line somewhere, our tendency now is to look down at our phones and, you know, what's that one email, what's that one tweet, whatever, that I'm missing out on, versus just kind of being there in that moment.
Yeah, there's a chapter in the book about my own phone detox. I did a 30-day phone detox. I actually had a coach, like a phone coach, guide me through a program because I am a total phone addict. And this was before the pandemic. I mean, you can imagine the screen time stats now. They're not pretty. But one of the hardest things to overcome was this feeling of just being bored, being alone with your thoughts, this feeling that people felt for millennia and that we have not had to feel in many years because we have these supercomputers in our pockets that can entertain us anytime we need to be entertained and stimulate us. And so a big part of this is sort of relearning how to be idle, how to be bored, how to be alone with our thoughts, because in many cases, that's where our big creative human breakthroughs come from, is from those moments in between, from the moments where we can let our mind wander and our thoughts cross-pollinate.
Kevin Roos, the book is called Future Proof. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And finally, talking of creative breakthroughs, we end with one epic attempt to escape COVID cabin fever. 28-year-old Tom Drury is skateboarding from Melbourne to Cairns, Australia, 4,000 kilometers along the East Coast. Along the way, he's tackling deadly snakes and scorching heat, but all for a good cause. He's raising money to help build the first skate park in Laos. He wants to bring his boarding love to enthusiasts in developing countries. But as he nears the finish line, you got to ask, how's he getting back? And that is it for now. You can always catch us online, on our podcast, and across social media. Thank you for watching, and goodbye from London.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country. Beyoncé and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.